Hi, I'm Deborah Lindad, and this is Toxic Free Talk Radio, where we talk about how to thrive in a toxic world and live toxic free. Today, we're going to be talking with toxicologist Dr. Stephen Gilbert, who's been on the show so many times, and I appreciate it every time he comes, because he's a real live toxicologist, and this is what he does all day long, is study what chemicals are toxic, how they're toxic, where they are, what to do about them. And he's written a wonderful book called A Small Dose of Toxicology. I've mentioned this book before, and I always say everybody listening should just go to his website and get a free copy of this book, because it not only talks about some of the major chemicals that you should be concerned about, but it also talks about some basic things about toxicology, and it's all written in a way that's very easy to understand. And so you'll want to go to his website, which is toxipedia.org, T-O-X-I-P-E-D-I-A, and get that sometime during a commercial or something, or after the show. But it certainly is something, a book that should be, I don't want to say on your shelf, because it's a e-book. It's probably not going to sit on your shelf, but it should be in your home. And you should have that information as part of just general background for living in the toxic world that we live in. Hi, Dr. Gilbert.
Hi, Deborah. Good to hear from you again.
Thank you. Nice to have you. Now, today we're going to be talking about persistent bioaccumulative toxicants. And this is something a little different than what we usually talk about, because it's not something that we generally find in consumer products on the label, although they definitely are in consumer products. But it's something that governments are concerned about accumulating in the environment. So tell us exactly what is a persistent bioaccumulative toxicant. And I know it also goes by other names, too. So tell us about those.
Yeah, it goes by other names. For example, PBTs, persistent bioaccumulative toxicants, is really from the U.S. EPA, and most of the states have chosen to categorize them like that. The United Nations calls them persistent organic pollutants, or POPs, and both agencies have developed lists of these chemicals, and the primary reason is because they're persistent in the environment. They do not break down. So they're persistent in the environment, and they're bioaccumulative in the sense that they move up the food chain, they accumulate in animals or plants, or in human bodies, and that's where it becomes more serious. And we've really learned to know from studying toxicology that very small amounts of some of these chemicals can produce adverse effects. So we're concerned about chemicals that persist in the environment and do not break down. And a classic example of this is DDT. You know, it's a well-known insecticide, widely used after World War II, and it was really the foundation for Rachel Carson writing Silent Spring, where she really laid out the case that DDT, although it might not seem toxic to humans, at least when we were thinking about it then, it was very toxic to birds and to the wildlife. So high predatory birds, such as eagles and hawks, that damage their ability to their chicks to survive because of the eggs would get crushed. And this was a very serious, caused a lot of damage to the bird population in the United States, and really showed the importance of understanding the ecological effects of the persistent chemicals and how they survive in the environment, what the consequences to wildlife is.
It's very important that I know most people have a lot of attention. I know I started out this way. I wasn't thinking about the environment at all. I was thinking about these consumer products are making me sick when I use them. And I know that a lot of people come into having interest in toxics by what the health effects are on themselves, or concern about their children, or women who are pregnant are concerned about their growing child in their womb. And but the environment is extremely important, is absolutely vital. We couldn't be alive without the environment. Everything that keeps our own bodies alive all comes from the environment. All the natural resources that are used to make the products that we use every day, our food, the air we breathe, the water we drink, all of those things come from the environment. And if we don't have an environment, then we don't have our own lives. And I think that's one of the most important things for people to know, and yet it's so widely not known in our culture today. that people just don't have that awareness.
Yeah, it's really true, because we have contaminated the environment, which ultimately leads to contamination of humans. For a really good example, this is our lead and mercury. I'll just focus on mercury for a moment.
Yes,
that mercury moves up the food chain when it gets out into the environment, and mercury is in coal, so you burn these coal-fired utility plants. And the EPA has passed some recent regulation trying to control the mercury effluent. But the mercury comes out of the coal, up the smokestacks, gets in the environment, and then it's converted into methyl mercury. So the inorganic mercury that's in coal is converted to organic mercury. And that organic mercury gradually moves up the food chain and accumulates in fish. So the big fish eat the small fish, and the small fish have eaten the bacteria and the snails that have accumulated the mercury. And it moves up the food chain. So fish that are on the top of the food chain, such as tuna, swordfish, shark, accumulate this mercury. And we now know that mercury has a very serious consequences for neurological development in children or infants. So we have contaminated a very important source of protein around the world, and we continue to do that with burning of coal. So it's really a global issue, and we've got to be thinking globally on these issues, and the coal that we ship to India and China comes back to haunt us in some interesting ways because of the bioaccumulative nature of methylmercury. We're on one big closed-loop system here. We've got to continue to recognize that.
I'd like you to just talk for a minute about how you just talked about how inorganic mercury in the environment gets changed to, wait, was it mercury or lead?
It changes from inorganic to organic.
Could you just explain that in a little more detail? Because it's the changing of the form by us using it that makes it more toxic, right?
Yeah, that's true. So when mercury is, and many people have probably played with little dolls of mercury because widely used in thermometers and thermostats. My old house used to have a thermostat with mercury in it, and you go in and pull the cover off that, and you can see a little mercury sloshing around in there. And they use that because it conducts electricity. So mercury is a really interesting metal, has a wide number of uses as a catalyst, and was used all over the place in many industries. And only in the last 20 years we really tried to control the mercury effluent and the mercury use. It's used, for example, in gold mining, because mercury attracts the gold. If you take your ring and put a little bit of mercury around it, it'll turn silver because the mercury adheres to the gold. But when you evaporate the mercury, and that's another important property, is it evaporates at room temperature. You heat it, the mercury is boiled away, and you're left with the gold in the gold mining. But just like with burning coal, you heat that coal, burn the coal, the mercury, the inorganic mercury goes up the smokestack and then into the environment. And in the environment, it's toxic. It's been used as a fungicide. For example, mercury was used in paint. It's used, a form of mercury was used in vaccines because it was very bacterial and fungal side. It killed those unwanted organisms. But these organisms also fought back, and they tried to convert it to detoxify the mercury. They convert it into methyl mercury. So they attach a methyl group to this mercury, and that's where it starts bioaccumulating up the food chain. Mercury interacts with protein. So it accumulates in the muscle of the fish, and the high predatory fish gradually accumulate more and more mercury. So the long, big, old tuna is likely to have quite a bit of mercury in it because we've spread mercury throughout the environment from burning of coal and other uses. And also mercury is somewhat naturally occurring in the environment, although at much lower levels. So this mercury moves up the food chain, contaminates the fish we want to eat, and that's a serious problem for kids and fetuses and women of childbearing age. We really want to limit the amount of mercury intake. So the FDA just came out with an advisory on mercury where they advise women of childbearing age and pregnant women to consume fish of low concentration of mercury. So fish that have little mercury in them, they're recommending increased consumption of and trying to avoid fish with high levels of mercury. So this is why I mentioned it's really as a global problem in the sense that we burn wherever mercury is let off into the environment, from burning coal, for example. We're contaminating our waterways. We've got fish advisories all over the United States and really around the world about trying to control the mercury in fish. And we continue to burn coal. And we know how to sequester the mercury from these coal-fired plants, but we don't do it because it's expensive to do. The owners would rather generate electricity and make money than use pollution control devices. So we're all culpable in this mess.
We need to go to break now, but we'll talk more about this when we come back because I have a question for you about tuna. I'm Deborah Lynn Dadd. This is Toxic Free Talk Radio, and I'm talking with Dr. Stephen Gilbert, toxicologist, and he's also the author of A Small Dose of Toxicology, which you can get for free at toxipedia.org, and we'll be right back. You're listening to Toxic Free Talk Radio. I'm Deborah Lynn Dadd, and my guest today is Dr. Stephen Gilbert, toxicologist. And we've been talking about persistent environmental bioaccumulative toxicants. It's got so many names, just a couple names. But it's all the same thing. So my question that I had about tuna is, of course, every child is fed tuna sandwiches. I didn't eat a lot of tuna because I didn't like it. But so many people eat tuna. It's just like standard lunchtime thing. And a lot of people eat tuna as sushi. Is there any tuna that is not contaminated?
Well, there are some fish that have lower mercury levels in them because they're like salmon, for example, are shorter-lived fish. So they live just for a couple of years. So they're not as high on the food chain as, for example, tuna are. So salmon generally has less mercury in it, although salmon, and mercury is important because we eat the meat, you know, the muscle of the fish where the mercury is. But right. For example, in salmon, they might accumulate for some DDT or PCBs, but they're in the fat of the salmon, not in the muscle. So you have to know where the chemical is accumulating to be wise about what to eat. So we try to choose fish that are low in mercury.
Okay, good. And the EPA has a list. I think that there's several lists, but the EPA just came out with one, right?
So there's several lists. The FDA just published a recent one. Most of the states have fish advisories. I know Washington State does. It sort of steers you to the fish to consume that are lower in mercury.
So should somebody be looking for their local state list because it would have local fish on it?
Yeah, most of them have local fish. There'll be local fish advisories, and they have to sort of consult them and know what fish tend to be for sports fishing. And I think the other thing to remember is that this is also an environmental justice issue because people that are high fish consumers can be lower on the social economic scale, and they're using fish for subsistence living, in a sense. And they eat more fish, and a range of fish so that they're exposed to other PCBs, DDTs, as well as mercury.
There's so much. It's just every time you turn around, there's another aspect of this. But I know for myself, I as a child, I just didn't like fish from the first bite. There was something about it I didn't like, and I always refused to eat fish and seafood, and it's still that way for me. I just put it in my mouth and I don't want it at all. Every once in a while, I try a bite of fish. But I think it might be just from the toxic chemicals that are in fish. I'm looking in your book, A Small Dose of Toxicology, and there's a whole chapter on this. And I see that, and so this is somebody, if you're listening to this and it seems like this is a lot of new information, you can just go to toxipedia.org and download A Small Dose of Toxicology. If you go to toxicfreetalkradio.com, there's a picture of the book there with the description of this show, and if you click on it, it'll take you right to the page where you can get this book for free. So,
In the chapter, and also in the PowerPoint presentation that goes with that chapter, I list out a table that has different chemicals in it that have been declared persistent bioaccumulative, or POPs, or I think I listed the Washington State list, too. So there's a range of chemicals and metals. Lead, for example, is persistent in the environment and bioaccumulates in the bone, for example. But it gives you a list of these chemicals. A lot of them are pesticides, you'll notice in that. And that came out of post-World War II when we thought we had a handle on all things chemical and knew how to manage the environment. And I just want to say Rachel Carson had a great quote from Silent Spring. He said, "As crude a weapon as a caveman's club, the chemical barrage has been hurled against the fabric of life." I really think that's what we've done in a lot of ways. And these lists really demonstrate that, how we've taken the chemicals and really hurled them at the fabric of life to create a lot of hazard in our own lives now.
You know, I was just going to mention these lists. That's why I was mentioning the book. Yes, these are good lists. And I think that the thing that strikes me when I look at them is that it contains, not only do things bioaccumulate in the environment, but they also bioaccumulate, these same chemicals and metals would bioaccumulate in our own bodies in the same way.
Yeah.
And so.
Yeah. I'm going to say lead's a great example of that, where if you're exposed to lead while you're growing up, that lead accumulates in the bone. And then, for example, during certain periods of life, or it might being during pregnancy, where the child is really a sink for calcium, so that bone is demineralized in the mom, and that lead, along with the calcium that's demineralized, goes into the child, the developing fetus. So persistent bioaccumulative toxicants are very serious, and you got to remember that the child and the fetus is very small, so a small amount of exposure represents a big dose to that developing fetus or developing child. So there's many ways that we have to be really careful with these compounds.
Well, tell us, we're about to go to break again, but I just want to finish saying what I was going to say, and then we'll go to break, and then we'll have a new question here. The things that really jump out at me that I didn't understand before that were persistence are lead, as you said, mercury. And here's another one, is tin. And I know that I did some research some years ago about tin because I bought a set of cookware that was lined with tin. And so I was trying to find out if that was safe. And of course, there's tin cans, but they aren't lined with tin anymore. But I didn't, at the time when I was doing that research, it didn't come up that it was a persistent metal. And so I'm no longer using that cookware for other reasons, but that's something that you do see in consumer products. So let's see what else is on the list. There's a lot of pesticides, PCBs, PBDEs, which tell us a little bit really quick about PBDEs.
So PBDEs are part of the category of flame retardants.
Right.
And they're a very persistent environment, as it turns out. And they're in the cushions and mattresses. They've started to be becoming banned. California's moved to that because these chemicals would get out into the environment. They would distribute all over the world and show up in women's breast milk when they're first noticed. And this is because they tend to accumulate in fat. So when a woman lactates, the fat is mobilized and the brominated flame retardants come out into the milk. So they're widely used to, and they're actually shown not to be effective in mattresses and cushions. And the reason a lot of these chemicals are used is sort of a money-making project for the chemical industry, because they're used to quench fires that might start from cigarettes. And the cigarettes were manufactured to burn down, so they didn't go out. And if cigarettes will naturally go out if you're not puffed on them, if you just roll your own. But initially, the tobacco industry made them so they did not go out. And then they added flame retardants in these mattresses and cushions because they thought that was a way to keep their cigarettes burning.
We need to go to break. You're listening to Toxic Free Talk Radio. I'm Deborah Lynn Dowd, and my guest today is Dr. Stephen Gilbert, toxicologist, and we'll be right back with more about these persistent chemicals. You're listening to Toxic Free Talk Radio. I'm Deborah Lynn Dadd, and my guest today is Dr. Stephen Gilbert, toxicologist, and we're talking about persistent chemicals in the environment. And, of course, if a chemical is persistent, then it's also going to be persistent in our bodies. Dr. Gilbert, I understand that some of these chemicals, now, these governments are tracking these chemicals because they're considering phasing them out, some of them. Can you tell us, like, where we are in the world in different countries about eliminating these chemicals? Because it's not really a consumer question. This is more a regulatory question, isn't it?
Yes, that's true. A lot of these chemicals have been phased out, particularly the pesticides. And they've also tried to control, for example, mercury and using gold mining and mercury products like thermometers and other things in schools and homes. They try to collect these back up. But pesticides are still widely out there, some of the old bad pesticides. And I'll give you an example of that. My wife's father died in November. And he was in his 90s, his mid-90s. And in cleaning out the house, we found old containers of DDT and Aldrin, two banned pesticides. And we took these to hazardous waste disposal. But this is an example of how these pesticides are still findable in home environment. And agricultural community use a lot of these, too. And they still show up in hazardous waste collection sites in the agricultural community. So despite the efforts to try to ban these things, in a sense, to ban the sale of them, they're still, because there's so much manufactured, they're still accessible in everybody's environment. So I think that, in a sense, we've done a good job of trying to understand the consequences of these and move toward pesticides, for example, that break down in the environment. So ultraviolet light breaks down the modern pesticides. But you have to be careful with tracking these pesticides indoors, because indoors you don't have the ultraviolet light, so they're more persistent inside. So you really have to be thoughtful about chemicals they use and where you're using them and how they break down.
That's a really good point. And this comes back to one of the things that I mentioned in my book, Toxic Free, was about leaving your shoes at the door and not wearing your shoes into the house. And this is exactly a reason why you should do that. Because if people, if your neighbor has DDT and they're spraying it on their lawn and you walk by the sidewalk, or your pet, you're walking your dog and the dog runs on the lawn or whatever. Oh, well, so what would you do about that? What if you're walking the dog, the dog goes running on the lawn and the lawn service has just come? I mean, you can take off your shoes at the door, but what about pets? They can't take off their shoes.
That's a good thing to raise. I think taking off your shoes is absolutely essential. You know, the three most important things to do are eat well, have good nutrition, take off your shoes, and wash your hands. Like, the first thing I do with my granddaughters when I come in the house is wash their hands. So it's sort of a chronic joke, wash hands, wash hands, wash hands. But trying to reduce exposure is really important. So with pets coming indoors, it's really important to keep the house well vacuumed and to mop the floors, this hardwood floor. But there's and also encourage your neighbors and others to use integrated pest management. So some provinces, particularly in Canada, have moved toward banning the cosmetic use of pesticides and herbicides. So we really are getting a little bit smarter and trying to control and reduce the use of these products, because a lot of times you don't need it. Going on doing a little weeding is good exercise, and we need to do a little bit more of that and a lot less application of pesticides.
I totally agree.
More about integrated pest management.
Yeah. So, let's see. What else can I ask you about these chemicals?
Well, one thing is PCBs, mm-hmm. polychlorinated biphenyl ethers. These are compounds that were used in transformers, still widely distributed in the environment. For example, the orca whales in Washington State that travel in our waters out here are some of the most contaminated creatures in the world. So these PCBs were spread all over when they were used, and they show up in women's breast milk. So that's a serious product. Washington State is just doing a chemical action plan for PCBs to know where they are. They show up in caulk and also in some paint still. So I think we still have a lot of work to do to try to corral these compounds. And PCBs are an example of compounds that go to fat. So the big reservoirs for persistent biocumulative toxicants, are they in the muscle? So if they're consumed, are they in the fat? So they have to concern about lactation if they're excreted in the fat, like PCBs, DDTs, chlorinated compounds, and brominated compounds like PBDEs. And we also have to worry about bone compounds that are stored to the bone. And the other thing I want to mention is persistent compounds. We shouldn't forget radionucleotides and radioactive particles that are very persistent in the environment that have half-lives in hundreds, thousands, even tens of thousands of years. And Fukushima, the nuclear plants that just had all the problems in Japan, are still putting nuclear isotopes out into the environment, and these are taken up by plants as well as fish. So there's lots of persistent compounds out there we need to be concerned about, and we, in general, need to control the use of these persistent compounds.
So I'm looking at this list, and I don't see the radionuclides on here. Am I just missing it? Or are they? Are there other? I guess here's the question. So I know that this list is you're summarizing these different lists, and you have columns that show which chemicals are on which lists that have been produced by governments. And so are there other ones that the governments haven't identified?
Yeah, I think that's probably true. I think these are lists of sort of some of the classic older ones. And I think as we understand how these compounds work in the environment, we have a better appreciation for them. But a lot of compounds do break down. For example, a good example is caffeine, which many of us widely consume caffeine, but it's readily metabolized in the body and excreted in our urine. So that's a compound that, you know, is not persistent or bioaccumulative, thank goodness, and but it does excrete it in the environment and shows up in the waterways. So, but the compounds that list in these lists are really the bad actors of the bad actors that we know have toxic adverse effects. They know they're persistent, and they know they bioaccumulate. So there are other compounds out there that are persistent but don't bioaccumulate as well, or are not quite as toxic, so they don't make this list. And I think you make a really good point about not having radiological compounds in these lists. And when I revise this chapter, which is coming up soon, I'm definitely going to add that into this list.
Yeah, because I'm looking at things here that I know we're being exposed to, the radioactive ones and the tin and the mercury and the lead, and those are, and they're, how can I say this? They're in consumer products, but they're also, this is what we're going to talk about after the break, which is coming up in, actually, let's go to the break and then I'll ask you the question. This is Toxic Free Talk Radio. I'm Deborah Lynn Dowd, and my guest today is Dr. Stephen Gilbert, toxicologist, and you can go to toxicfreetalkradio.com, see the description of the show today, and click on the book cover of A Small Dose of Toxicology. It'll take you right to the page where you can get this book for free. We'll be right back. You're listening to Toxic Free Talk Radio. I'm Deborah Lynn Dowd, and my guest today is Dr. Stephen Gilbert, toxicologist. His website is toxipedia.com, but you can go to my website, toxicfreetalkradio.com, and click on the cover of his book, A Small Dose of Toxicology, and you can get that book for free. And it also has a link to toxipedia.com, .org. Is it .com or .org? I don't have it right in front of me. .org, I think.
It's mostly .org, but .com works too.
Okay. All right. Good. If you can't figure out how to spell Toxipedia, then just go to ToxicFreeTalkRadio.com and there's a link right there. All right. So the question that I wanted to ask you is, we talk a lot about reading labels, but these chemicals are in the environment and they're showing up in consumer products through the raw materials that are used to make the consumer products and water and things, you know, that it just says water. It doesn't say what is contaminating the water. And so because these chemicals are so widespread, then they show up in many, if not all of our products as contaminants. And this isn't on the label.
Right, that's really true, because we don't, these things are technically contaminants, they're not part of the product. For example, that there were some incidents where calcium supplements had lead in them because the animals that were used to get the calcium from were contaminated with lead. So this is a problem. It's on toys, for example. Lead's used in paint, so it shows up on toys, and lead's a little bit sweet, so kids that consume the lead chips off that product or get it onto their hands. You see the lead. And so that's a real issue. We don't know sometimes which fish have the mercury in them. So we can't really buy smart in that sense. And the Food and Drug Administration, in my view, needs to, you know, be more consistent about enforcing the lead mercury contamination in fish levels. And I also want to mention tin. You really have to know what form these products are in. Like tin is a metal. Is not so toxic, but when tin becomes organic tins, gets methyl groups attached to these tins, that's when they become toxic. And these toxic material was used as paint foulants on boats So it's used on boat hulls to keep off barnacles and things like that, because organotins are very toxic compounds. So they tend to accumulate in ports and harbors. And we're just cavalier with very toxic compounds because we try to do things on the cheap. So it's cheaper to put these organotins on the hulls of boats so you don't have to scrape the barnacles off. But we don't account for the consequences of putting this material out into the environment. So we need to be much wiser about and really account for the cost of these materials. We're not externalizing the costs onto the wildlife and onto humans, which ultimately happens in many of these situations.
That's such a good point. I think that another thing that I talk about a lot, but I think I need to keep saying it until it actually makes a change in the world, is that I know that for myself, as part of my own personal process, I started out just having the same ideas and viewpoint about things as most people in our current society. But I went through a change where I realized that if I didn't have some concern for first my own life and my own health, and then concern for all of life, if I didn't make the first question that I ask, is this toxic, or how does this support or harm life? How does it support or harm my body? How does it support or harm the ecosystems? If I didn't ask that as my first question, then I wouldn't end up with the right answer. And that, to me, is the missing question, is that people don't ask themselves that question. They don't say, like, for myself, I refuse to use toxics. I just refuse. If the only way to do something is a toxic way, I just don't do it. Like, I don't wear fingernail polish.
Yeah, that's a really important choice to be made when we consumer products and using personal care products and what toxics are in those things. And it doesn't have to be, if this is about human toxicant, to be a hazard. For example, bisphenol A, BPA, is fairly quickly metabolized, but we're constantly exposed to it. So we have this sort of background level of these materials, and in that sense, it is a toxic compound that we need to be paying attention to. Just because it's not, quote-unquote, persistent environment doesn't mean we're not chronically exposed to it. So I think those are really important questions to ask. Like my neighbor, I refuse to use pesticides on our lawn and our driveway gets weeds in it. So I go out there and weed the thing. Or our neighbor tends to use pesticides, herbicides to kill this material. And I just think that's the wrong way to go. We should not be doing that.
Well, do you have any suggestions? I know I get this question a lot. What I'm about to ask you is, how can I control what my neighbors do?
Yeah, that's a tough one. I think they just need more education about integrated pest management and talk to them about, do they really need to be using these fairly noxious chemicals that are potent defoliants, or potent herbicides? And I think my attitude is we just need to keep talking to people and try to educate people, barring more regulatory approaches. And the real approach, in my view, is regulation, where we just have to say to people, we're not, these chemicals are no longer going to be for sale. You can't use chemicals to beautify your lawn. You need to get out there and use other means to do that that are not as toxic and not putting these materials out in the environment. Because they get into the soil, they eventually get washed down into the waterways, and out in our situation, it's Puget Sound, which is really unfortunate.
When I was in San Francisco, I was born and raised in the San Francisco Bay Area and then moved to Florida, but I went back to visit about 7 or 8 years ago, and one of the things, they have a very good office of environmental affairs in San Francisco, in the city of San Francisco, and they do a lot of education of the people there, and I have to say this, I have to say that they do allow chickens, backyard chickens, in the city of San Francisco. And I have to say that because they're not allowed in my little suburban town of Clearwater, Florida. And I keep saying this, but it just outrages me that the police came and took my chickens. And that is an example of bad regulation. But what I wanted to say is that when I was there, they were doing a big campaign to educate people about mercury and the disposal of mercury in thermometers and in fluorescent lights, because there was so much mercury in San Francisco Bay.
Yeah, mercury has been a very serious pollutant, and some of the old gold mines will be contaminated with mercury because mercury has been widely used in gold mining operations. And in Washington State, and I think San Francisco too, we've had mercury take-back programs for schools, high schools, and businesses. And, you know, they've tried to really try to get mercury out of blood pressure measurement equipment and out of thermometers used in almost all situations that have mercury. So if anybody has a mercury thermometer, they should really take it to hazardous waste and dispose of it properly, and because we just do not want to have that mercury get out into the environment because it ends up in our fish that we consume. So you really have to look at the loop that this where the mercury goes. So I was really glad to hear that San Francisco is trying to control its mercury. That's great news.
Yeah, me too, because San Francisco is known for its seafood. I mean, people go there and go to Fisherman's Wharf and they, you know, the fresh catch comes in, and it's really important to not only the health and the environment of San Francisco, but to the economic well-being, because you don't want people to go to San Francisco and be poisoned by the mercury in the seafood they had the tourists. Now, I'm not saying, I don't think that that's ever happened, that, you know, somebody ate a crab or something and then had to be rushed to the hospital. I mean, I don't know. It may have, but I've never heard of it. And I haven't heard of everything. But it just, you know, it's part of the overall load of chemicals, the body burden that eventually makes people sick. And
that's a really good point. We're not exposed to just one of these chemicals. We're exposed to all kinds of chemicals, from PCBs, a little bit of DDT, a little bit of mercury, a little bit of lead. So it's a cumulative effect of all these chemicals we're exposed to. And mercury can be, you know, consumed, high consumers of mercury-laden fish as adults can have pretty serious consequences of that. There have been several incidents of adult exposure. I just co-authored a paper about a year and a half ago, you know, documenting some of these cases where and trying to come up with better messaging for adults that are consuming mercury-laden fish. So we really got to be thinking about this, and the point that you raised about multiple chemical exposures is a really good one. And if small amounts of a whole bunch of chemicals equals a large dose of toxic properties.
Yes, and that's why I'm not so concerned anymore about how much am I being exposed to one chemical. I mean, people are often asking me, well, what's the safe level for this and what's the safe level for that chemical? And to me, my conclusion is just we just need to be aware of as many chemical exposures as we can be, learn as much as we can, and reduce our exposure as much as we can, because the reality is that we really don't know what's in the products. Even if we read labels, I think the best we can do is use that label reading to eliminate as many chemicals that are known. But we're still not going to end up with having zero toxic exposure because of the environmental contamination. Anyway, the show, we've only got about 30 seconds. So any final words?
My final word would be on this chemical exposure. People need to work toward better chemical policy. You know, we need to reform TSCA and have a better chemical policy when environmental chemicals and better knowledge about what the health effects of these potential of these chemicals is. So chemical policy reform is absolutely critical for our environment, for our human health.
Thank you so much, Dr. Gilbert, for being with us, and I'm sure we'll talk to you again. You're listening
You're
to Toxic
welcome.
Free
Thank
Talk
you.
Radio. You can go to ToxicFreeTalkRadio.com to find out more about the show and what's coming up and listen to past shows and even listen to this show again. I'm Deborah Lynn Diaz. Be well.